Yes, I did it. All right, so we are going to pass the mic on over to Theo Henderson and Lexis Olivier Ray, who are going to be guiding our conversation about housing today. And then, for sure, and then be open for question and answers at the end as well. So, passing it on over.
Thanks for joining us, everybody, and Savannah and Natalie for putting this together. My name is Lexis Olivier Ray. I am a multimedia reporter, writer, and artist. I contribute to a website called LATaco.com, and I'm joined by Theo Henderson, podcaster, activist. I'll let Theo introduce himself.
Well, I always when I'm always kindly interviewed or introduced, I'm always wondering if they're talking about someone else. But but I also have to give out a shout out to Mr. Ray, as his activism and his journalism as well has shown a lot of spotlight on very integral things in the respect of police brutality, corruption, and basically just wrongdoing on our elected leaders. And how that connects with the housing crisis, and what the conversation that I would like to shift toward today is, because if they can do that to people that have house a privilege, imagine what they can do with the unhoused community. So he's been on hand during the pandemic, one of the most influential people that have been looking at simple things like sheltering in place, hand washing stations where they're serviceable, and those kind of important things that are very pivotal in cutting out the spread of the COVID-19, and holding the city accountable and understanding that in order for us to get a hold, a stranglehold on to the vaccine and the safety measures, we have to look at the unhoused community. My story is a little bit different in the respect that I was on the opposite end. I have been unhoused for 8 years, and during that time, I have noticed a very deep chasm of understanding, or lack thereof, and it motivated me to not want other unhoused people to go through this. And thus, it created a lot of things like the housing issues, because most often than not, if you ask people about houselessness, they will say it's something that's a personal defect of the individual. They are not working hard. They are substance usage addicted. They are mentally ill, or they just don't want the best things in life like everyone else. And they will always kind to have a finger wagging kind of introduction and to their idea of capitalism. We are in a capitalist country. Why are you not doing your part? You want to hand out, pick yourself up by your bootstrap. You've heard it. We hear it more often than you can believe. And so it motivated me to say, you know what, I'm going to do something very different. I'm going to create a platform, not only with my creativity and my talent and art, and I'm going to use it to, because I'm an educator as well. I'll educate. I taught for over 18 years in schools. I taught from immigrant families, children, adults, middle school. I also taught for a summer at UCLA in a gifted program. I understand that in order to get into the light of understanding, you have to create the perfect way of introducing material that could be synthesized and digested, that people can get it and be able to not only do that, motivate them to do some positive changes as well. I think I've talked too much about my intro, but I hope that I hope that answered the question. Lex, I'll take it back to you.
I'm very humbled by that introduction, Theo. Thank you. Me and Theo actually met in December of 2019. I just want to state that I was the first person to interview Theo about his podcast. Since then, he's been interviewed by everybody. He's always in the news, and that started because Mark Horvath, the director of Invisible People. He heard about Theo's podcast before it launched, and he was really excited about it. And he introduced me to Theo, and we sat down, in Chinatown and talked for a bit. And since then, we continue to see each other mainly in the field. And,
yeah.
You know, it's rare for us to be able to have a conversation because we're usually running in opposite directions, you know, trying to cover one thing or another. We actually just saw each other this weekend.
In front of you said it, yeah, because it was kind of definitely dramatic. I apologize. We don't have it that exciting on our Saturday, but it was like, it was a good event. It was glad to see him. Like I say, you know, we have a power up every Saturday, and we had a member that had got ill. So, like I say, it was not as promised. It's not that dramatic every Saturday.
No need to apologize. Yeah, Theo had to deal with a medical emergency when we were speaking. But just to get into my process a little bit, that's kind of a good example of how I work. And I also want Theo to talk a little bit more about what Power Up is, because it's pretty remarkable what he's created. But basically, I just went out over the weekend to join Theo. And, you know, I love to be on the ground and in the streets. I think if you're going to be covering housing and the unhoused community, you really got to be out in the field. It's not the type of subject that you can just cover from the office. So I go out in the field a lot, and it's not always necessarily for a particular story, but, just observing Theo work and showing my face, catching up with some other people that I know, meeting new faces, all that contributes to stories in the future. You never know when, an experience or a person will turn into a source or an interview or a story. So yeah, I'd love for you to tell people more about what Power Up is, Theo.
Well, Power Up came from the idea during my episodes at Weedian House. And I had seen different ways that people are doing power-ups, like Streetwatch has a different version, but still very impactful. And I've seen other organizations doing it, but as from the unhoused perspective, I wanted it to have a little bit more nuance, a little bit more subtlety, and a little bit more open up discussions. For example, I wanted to emphasize on harm reduction, trauma-informed care, and these terms from house perspectives, they don't know what that is. What the hell is a trauma-informed care? Trauma-informed care is a little bit different, the opposite of the DSM-4. Instead of us calling the police to correct someone that has a episode or a psychotic break, we don't do that. We as a community take care of the person's belongings, try to de-escalate the situation without a stick, gun, or taser, and they could be able to finish their episode, and they are confident and secure in knowing that they are safe and they are enfolded back into the community. And harm reduction is that we're meeting unhoused people, that substance use should not be the panacea for people to call the police as well, because it is a medical condition. And so we create environments where we give them Narcan. Like last Saturday, there was a gentleman that was overdosing, and we had our Narcan. And usually the first response that people would do would call the police or judge the person and treat the person harmfully. So one of the members contacted me, and I immediately tried to make sure the person was safe, and not when to use Narcan and when not to use Narcan, because you're meaning well. And if the person is still breathing, you can put them into a cardiac arrest. So you have to be understanding those nuances, making sure that they are breathing. If they have a labored breathing or whatever the breathing is, we making sure that the person is safe. And that when we do have medical attention his way, that is not is going to harm the person, because some cases, unhoused people don't want to be going to the police or the ambulance because they lack bedside manner. So my Power Up meets unhoused people where they are. We also meet the uncomfortable subjects of the sex workers and the issues that they may need, like, for example, prophylactics or cleaner, different other instruments that they use to do their work to survive. And the same with the with people that have substances. We have clean kits, so they don't want, because there's a high epidemic of hepatitis out there because they're reusing or recycling the same instruments and infecting, and not only dealing with substance usage, they're also dealing with the medical issues that prevail with using dirty instruments. So all of these things circle into what they unfold with unhoused people. We deal with people that, like, there's a gentleman that has Alzheimer's. What does that entail? You know, and he's elderly. There's a higher, a growing elderly population that are unhoused, and people are still running around telling them to get a job. So that's not applicable. Then we have the unhoused that are disabled. Like, I don't know, remember, Lex, we were out there. I don't know if we were out there, Lomita LaCoy, together in Harbor City. There's a gentleman out there. He's dying of cancer, skin cancer. And one of the rules on the city is that you have to have your tent down at a certain hours of the day. It's also arbitrary by the police officers, but this gentleman has skin cancer and he uses that tent because he has no place, and he's been trying to get into a place to be able to go to chemotherapy, which he's doing chemotherapy and dealing with the sores and things outside in the elements. And, you know, those are the complexities. And when we talk about houselessness, that continues to motivate me to go out there and make sure that we tell the stories from the unhoused lens instead of house people pontificating and getting the story wrong.
Yeah, one thing I've learned recently as a journalist, I've been doing a project with USC, an engagement journalism project. And through that, one thing I really learned that stuck with me is that as a reporter, many reporters, they write about the unhoused community for the housed community. Mm-hmm. You know, they break down what's happening at City Hall to inform, you know, people that are housed about what they can expect. But being out in the field and working on this engagement project, I learned that, you know, unhoused people need information as well, and they're not always getting that information. And if they are, it's not necessarily written for them. So the project I'm working on, it involves hand washing stations, for instance. And, you know, you can write a story about that for the housed community, but unhoused residents, they're interested in knowing just where they are, where they can find hand washing stations so they can wash their hands. Which is something I think that not all journalists would think about if they're writing about that, like just informing people where they are so they can wash their hands.
And you do sweep schedules. And I find that very helpful as well when I'm going out covering different areas too, because what I also noticed that the city has a sweep schedule, but they don't always necessarily follow it. Like, for example, today I was out in the valley in North Hollywood, and it was outside of a special enforcement zone, and they were sweeping and displacing unhoused people because they were doing construction, and there was no notification. It was just spontaneous, and they just displaced unhoused people. And then they, after all of the heat index, they proclaimed to be offering services as well after they threw away most of the people's belongings. So I tip my hat off to, because out of all the mainstream media outlets that can still continually cater to house people's sensibility, house council members, and let's not kid ourselves, not in my backyard or NIMBY sentimentalities.
Yeah, through the engagement project, I started a texting service, which people can subscribe to. It's geared towards advocates and unhoused residents as well. And one of the things I do is typically Monday through Friday, I send out the sanitation schedules, which outline the various sweeps, as they're known, sanitation cleanings that are used as a pretext to often displace and criminalize unhoused community members. And I send them out to people in the morning. It's something that you can also get via email. Adrian Riskin is actually the guy that gets them from the sanitation department. But I've heard from people that it is really helpful to get it on their phone. You know, they might be out and about and not be able to check their email, but most people, they have a phone and they check it.
Absolutely. Like I say, it also helps in some ways of me created thematically my episode sometimes, and looking like, for example, this episode that I do, it sweeps because I lately have been going to a lot of sweeps and I'm noticing the different nuances to sweeps, the different county, city, the arbitration of NIMBY influence type of sweeps, and then to getting the stories, because so often in that, people will only hear the side of house people's disdain. I'll give you a case, an example. They have a situation right now in South LA. that there are encampments near a school and people are up in arms because the unhoused are in school. And it really, it shaped the way I thought about. And I said, for example, I have not ever heard, and I know most people have never heard of any unhoused person going into a school and shooting up a bunch of kids. But we have heard of white people running in and shooting up mass shootings. They don't, the unhoused people do that. They're just basically survived. There and I, you'd never heard of unhoused people riding by in their tent or scooter doing a drive-by because they're unhoused, and it's a ludicrous thing. But we as society or civilized society, and I use the word loosely, tend to cling to these unrealistic stereotypes about houselessness or not understanding that when we create a back channel or backlash for places for them to be, it's partly the NIMBY's fault. So they're going to be on the street. They can't fly up in the clouds. You know, they're not going to disappear because we don't want to see them. Because if we move them one area, they're going to be in another neighborhood. So the issue is that, which I would like us to like maybe talk a little bit about, which house people always creating solutions for unhoused people without the input on unhoused people is tiny homes, what I call tiny sheds. But I'll let leave that for you to lead us into that.
Yeah, so something that the city has been talking a lot about is using housing as a way to clear encampments. Because as it is now, if you can't provide housing for people, they have nowhere to go. But if you can offer them some sort of interim shelter, then you can essentially force them off the streets and then bring in cops and make sure that they don't come back. So we saw that in Echo Park Lake last month or in March actually. And the city is talking about replicating those actions in other parks and other parts of the city. And to go to the tiny homes. Yeah. Another, you know, they're housing or they're sheltering people, I should say, because there's a difference between housing and sheltering people in everything from hotel rooms to these tiny homes or tiny sheds, as some people refer to them, 70 square feet of living space with no private bathrooms.
And then you're sharing space with strangers. But also, let's be clear, tiny homes is used as a political ploy to get people that are not dialed into the houselessness conversation. And they're be able to justify it when people push it back against that that's not a home, it's temporary. All of these things have three things that makes it an unsavory proposition to many unhoused people. The people that service these people, the things that people that prompt or promote these things are the city, who has endorsed criminalization of poor people, ticketing them, putting them in jail for being poor. The second thing is that neighborhood councils and NIMBYs applaud these kind of actions. They push the city, they write these letters, and well-meaning people that are against them, they don't. They just sit there, just shake their head and go on about their business. But they mobilize and they make such a ruckus that they could make sure that they get these kind of horrific ideas passed. But to be clear, most unhoused people look at these things as punitive. It has a carceral effect. Now imagine if you were being thrown into a place and told that you have a curfew at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and if you're not there, you lose your bed. Or someone beats on the door two or three times in the middle of the night or the day to do bed checks or room checks, like you're in like you're in a jail cell. Or then, like for example, the activist I interviewed was telling me that they had lockdown rehab, that they couldn't even have a bath towel because they claimed that unhoused people would clog toilets. So they will give a large piece of a paper towel for the week for them to wipe themselves off after taking a bath. They took the TVs out. They take any type of amenity that creates a humanistic kind of response to unhoused. They couldn't have a refrigerator. They couldn't have they couldn't even have their own food because it's not acceptable. For whatever ridiculous rules that they have, it is like, and then when we talk to unhoused people and we tell them that they don't want those kind of services, they use the term service resistant, and they make sure all of the folderol that goes with that, they're saying, you know, they don't want help. And I'm sorry to say, most of mainstream people believe it because they haven't been unhoused. We have been indoctrinated to believe the police are above reproach. The city got our best interests at heart, and these people are the problem.
Yeah, and that's why I feel like as a journalist, it's really important to, again, be out in the field and, you know, listening to people, really. I mean, not even that's like, I was going to say speaking to people, but a lot of it is really just listening and observing.
Also, if I may interject, because I want to talk about, because I understand that there are people that are in the helping services, like social service. And I always wish there's two things. The first thing I wish that the mayor, the city council spends a year and a half in these shelters or these carceral places, and they cannot get out of it because of the lesson of their position, that they stick into those and endure that. The second thing I wish is for the social workers that are involved with unhoused people, and they get, they either burn out or lose their bedside manner, to go and encounter this kind of lifestyle themselves and understand, for example, how arduous it is for unhoused people have to be at a place like 2 to 3 hours. And what does that really entail if they're living out on the street? Or when for these appointments, they make these rules, because I can tell you that when you lose all of your things and you lose your appointment, and then when you try to make an appointment, they just cavalierly dismiss your needs. Well, you didn't show up, someone else took your spot. Not understanding the new trauma that they've inflicted, even though they're supposed to be helping, or they are tied in or connected with the police department, and not understanding that the police are not there to help them, and they buddy themselves with the police, especially with people that have mental health issues. They create the issues that they're violent, and then they can't do anything about it. So these issues that many of the people that I interview tell me these stories, and in my own experience, I say, you know what, if we are to take any type of change, we're going to have a very watershed moment and understanding maybe we should not be centering on some dusty old disinterested or arrogant pontificating shelter head like Andy Bales or these sheltered ideas or Ken Kraft that has these pro-police ideas. Maybe we should listen to the unhoused, because after all, if you're hurting and you have something wrong with you, and I keep telling you that it's not you don't have cancer, you just have a paper cut, and you keep saying all of the symptoms of it, and we keep talking all over you, you would be enraged and pissed off about it. And the same respect is not accorded to unhoused people. Like, for example, Pasadena For All has a bunch of people, house people up there talking about getting to know your neighbor, about unhoused people and tiny homes. And I made a response about it. I says, how dare you sit up and tell people of their experience that you wouldn't know what the first thing to do the first night to be unhoused. I asked them all the time, what did you do your first night in your house? All unhoused people can tell you that. I can tell you that. But people that sit on and work in these places, they can't tell you. They wouldn't know what to do. So how in the hell are you going to be able to tell people that are unhoused and living in these environments and dictate what their solutions for them in their life? And there are no unhoused people sitting on the panel. And only person you have is an echo chamber is a formerly unhoused person that you're going to trot out to say that they know the experience. So these power dynamics need to be explored even much more deeper. But I digress.
I'd love for you to tell people more about your podcast. You report in Los Angeles, but also in other places, and you're looking to expand the places that you report on. What sort of parallels have you seen between what's going on in LA and in other communities?
You know, I had fallen victim myself of thinking LA was the anomaly. And when I started going out to like San Jose, Santa Barbara, San Diego, Oakland, San Francisco, and dealing with the unhoused communities there, there is an underpinning of a threat that all house people share. They despise poor people. So it's just that I think the city of LA has much more of an involved way of discarding human dignity and people that are down on the luck. But one of the things that also I'm trying to, because I was reached out to someone in Canada. They want me to do a Weedian House in Canada because of that same NIMBYism that seems to permeate like an infection all through the country. Then I'm going to Arizona and Las Vegas this summer and dealing and communicating with the unhoused as well. So there is such a need for The stories, it's so amazing when I hear unhoused people contact me or they are reaching out and finally feel like someone is really listening to me. They're not talking over me. They're not using me as a 5-minute soundbite. They actually, people complain, oh my God, your podcast is long. I'm like, well, because it's not for you. It's for unhoused people to see themselves reflected humanely. You can sit there and shut your mouth and listen, but if you want to learn, this is what they're doing, and they want to be able to tell their stories without someone telling it for them. If you can sit to Game of Thrones, you can sit to white male angst of Dances with Wolves, certainly you can sit there and listen to unhoused people living through their experiences, because they live it 24/7, and they don't have a pause on their TV and can go get something from the refrigerator and the things in life goes on. It's a very arduous experience, and it's a very traumatic and very painful experience. So.
Yeah, one of the, I consider it a compliment now. I was interviewing an unhoused person in Echo Park like a year ago, and I'll never forget, they said, "You're the only reporter I know that doesn't ask questions." which, you know, you can take either way. A lot of reporters ask a lot of questions, but I just want to stress, I think it's really important.
What's that? Or miss the mark. They can ask all the questions that are not germane to their experience and miss the mark. But like you say, you ask probing questions that get them to communicate about themselves. That's the difference.
Exactly. Yeah. Giving people an opportunity to speak. And I find that a lot of times people are surprised that I'm down to just listen to them.
And the fact that, too, that we have that's infiltrated in the unhoused community is people that have, and I am not disparaging religion, but we have an infection with fanatical religious people who have believed that they are doing God's work, but they are also doing a major lot of harm, like Ken Crabb, Andy Bales. They are not for the unhoused people. And I could tell you some horrible stories, but the idea is anytime that you're going to these places and openly okay with demonizing unhoused people, but then you're trying to think that you're doing the Lord's work, that's a different thing. As weirdly, Lex, it was funny that I had one of the unhoused people, a couple of power-ups ago, they asked me, what church are you at? Because before they got in line, we told them, we're not from, you could see like, oh my God, thank God. Because, you know, because usually churches you got to sit there and hear them yelling, preach at you or telling you you're going to hell, that you're living a life of sin or whatever. And I service everybody, the LGBT, physical divergent, I don't care. And these things have infected Skid Row and other places, and they make it conditional that you get the services. And the difference is like, you know, like the Salvation Army, they're against transgendered community members. And, you know, but people tout them as a place to throw them into this. So they are creating more harmful spaces than they are good.
Yeah, one thing you pointed out about Power Up as well is just that you're trying to target areas where there are less resources for unhoused community members. Could you just talk a little bit about how, you know, services are structured in LA?
Well, one of the things that we have to give, if I could give a little history, I'm going to put my teacher hat on a bit, to give a little history about how houselessness has been faced. It is an old idea from the old poor laws of 1536. But it is transmogrified themselves to, because we have a puritanical religious slant that he who does not work does not eat. And as time had progressed, there was a conversation by a nun that says if we could contain the poor in certain areas like Skid Row, because that's where the hobos or the white unhoused people had congregated during different times in World War II, during Depression and that time. And it became, changed a different color after the civil rights and the introduction of or infiltration of crack cocaine in the communities, in underserved communities. So it became an issue that Skid Row was the only place that people would go. I had people telling me, if you wanna get services, go down to Skid Row. Now, I don't have substance uses, but I'm disabled, but go down to Skid Row. When, you know, I'm fleeing domestic, go down to Skid Row. Well, I'm elderly and got this a dementia, go down to Skid Row. I mean, that was the issue that I had. And I love that Skid Row gets help, But when I started living in other places like Chinatown, Little Tokyo, Koreatown, Santa Monica, these places held a dearth of services. They did not have enough services. And it shouldn't have to be that unhoused people have to make a 2 to 3 hour or a day trip to go down to get services that they may not get because it got left such a need down there, such a line just to get fed. So I was motivated, and I insist when I partner with other organizations, I said, we must go somewhere besides outside of Skid Row, because I don't want to be tacked on people thinking like we are in some religious fanaticism. I don't want to be tacked on that we are going to withhold services if they have, you know, they have like what we had Saturday, Alex, but the guy had a overdose. You know, it happens. We know that. That's why you're out here. We understand that. But you're still going to get services. You're still going to be helped. I'm not telling you you're going to hell. And I'm not telling you that, you know, you need to be doing this and putting yourself up by your bootstraps. You need a job. Just stay no to drugs. I'm not Nancy Reagan. So I don't understand that idea. We meet people where they are, because if they're broken, we broken class cuts, and we do the same things in order for us to cope and go through day to day. Nobody has, it's without reproach.
Yeah, I was really impressed with the way you handled that situation and kept your cool throughout. It was really impressive. One thing I've noticed in my reporting is that some of these more far-flung places that have less services, they also experience a lot of NIMBYism, vigilante, criminalization. Yeah. I've seen you in the Valley in Van Nuys, and, you know, on Etna Street, and I know you've also been down in the South Bay as well, covering sweeps there. I wonder if you could talk about that correlation a bit.
You know, NIMBYism is like it's like various degrees of like cancer. Some NIMBYism here, like here in the major city of downtown proper, they have their own form, but like in the Valley, it's really unchecked. You probably have seen it too. It's because they have the support of the city council. It's in a far-flung place. It is hard for activization of activists to come and report on the scene. And what it really pushed me to start doing it was unhoused people, when they would see in the Valley and they would contact, you really got to come out here to show it, you know. And I get so many requests from New York and like Canada. I even get it over in UK. People want me to go and cover it, because it's like, I know, I'm like, damn, it's everywhere. But it's like, when I would go down there and I noticed, I'm like, dude, I could see why people are affected, because you wouldn't know that they're being swept at 2 o'clock in the morning, or you wouldn't know that they're being harassed by the police, because people think the police are just doing their job, or they just, they may have took a kitten out of the tree they see on a video or in social media, but they don't see at the middle of the night when there's no one around, that terrorizing unhoused people, trying to, for example, for the immigrant community, there is an immigrant family that had COVID-19. And during COVID-19, the cops would incessantly come in and sell her husband, who was undocumented, and that he was going to have him deported and take her child. These kind of things. And these are cops selling this, not, you know. And when you do this so much, and when you don't have anyone there that cares or anyone that reports, mainstream media is not covering that. You don't hear any stories on Channel 2 News. You hear about some horrible crime of an unhoused person does something to a housed person, but you don't hear housed people doing these kind of horrible things. Like in Venice, about the people that are in police protection because of housed people are running up on their encampments and setting them on fire. You know, like the encampment fire that was out in Eagle Rock. People were up in arms thinking it was unhoused people until it was discovered. It was this Chamber of Commerce son who is housed that has set fire and killed these unhoused people. But you don't see those kind of conversations come up in polite conversation. You only hear about the unhoused acts or behaviors.
Yeah, and by the way, that man from Eagle Rock was recently charged, but it took a while for him to be charged. I believe like a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that we have time for questions. Savannah, how are we doing on time?
We're doing good. Thank you.
Okay, cool. How much time do we have roughly?
The class goes until 6:50. I'm sorry, 6:50. No, I'm kidding. Start at 5. It goes until Natalie, I'm blanking out.
I thought it was until 6, but is it 6:15?
Oh, yeah, I was getting worried. Like, okay. Like, what the heck?
So, yeah, the class goes until 6:50, but you don't have to take that full time. But there's plenty of time if you want to continue conversation and for question and answers.
Well, yeah, I think, too, we could return back having a conversation, but if we want to get some time for people to have questions or some moderation of that, I'm open to that as well, because I'm really hoping that the people in the class have taken the time to look at the videos, because there's a lot of to unpack there, because it's not just, I just didn't throw videos together. I have reasons why I do certain things. So.
Yeah, hopefully people have time to watch some of Theo's videos. He not only does the podcast, but also produces videos as well. I guess I would love for, if anyone has any questions or, wants us to discuss anything, maybe throw stuff in the chat.
I have a question. Thank you both for being here today. I'm not a housing expert, so I'm sorry. I don't really know, a lot on housing policies and stuff, but I guess I'm just curious what your thoughts are on the housing first model and how that's worked in California, because I know that, the housing first approach wasn't really met with success in California, mostly because they had so many restrictions as to who could be housed and stuff like that, right? And so I guess I'm just wondering, is the housing first model still the predominant, approach in terms of policy solutions in California, or I guess what are your thoughts on that?
Housing first on its face is a wonderful solution. Unfortunately, that it could have been fleshed out and developed, but unfortunately, basically many times it's been derailed is by NIMBYism. And politicians don't want to have the courage to tell NIMBYism, the reason why we can't do these things is because of you, because they know that they're going to have to be going up for re-election. Housing first means to me, it's with supportive services, such a cornucopia of people that need different things. So when we say an unhoused person that has substance usage and we put them in, let's say for example, Project Room Key, and he relapsed, we throw them out. Okay, that's not helping. We knew he had a substance usage problem. He's not magically going to just stop. We don't have the services there to create that. Or like the gentleman, Black Wolf, he used to tell me, which is he's right, that I'm schizophrenic. It's I don't have my medication. So if I don't have the medication and I have an episode, you throw me, how is this helping me? I mean, that's where we are. I mean, we've got to understand that there's people who have all sorts of issues, from skin cancer, from domestic abuse, or people who are filled with trauma. They're not going to be skipping down the street swing with a Coke and a smile. We've got to face the reality that human behavior, human things, that we have to meet people where they are. In order for housing first to work, we have to make sure we have to follow up. Like for example, in a Project Room Key, there were 11 overdoses. And the reason why is because we didn't have harm reduction there. We didn't have people there to understand, but let someone come in there and they have an episode, they're going to throw them out. So, and which creates this continual cycle of disconnectedness.
Yeah, I'll just add one thing I learned early on reporting on the unhoused community. A counselor told me that a house is more than a roof over your head. Mm-hmm. It's not just enough to put somebody in a room or, essentially a box. Like Theo said, you also need services that go with that. And, you need to tailor housing for different people in different communities. So I think, like Theo said, it can work, but it's more complicated than just building housing units. And also I'll add to that is I think, housing is about community in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So people are isolated. Like, I wrote a story about a gentleman that was run over by a car. I watched him get run over by a car, an unhoused man. And I helped him get into a Project Room Key location. But that location was all the way on the west side. And, you know, he's near like Echo Park. So that took him away from the community that he's been in for years, where he knows people and where people help him out. And they stuck him on the west side. And, you know, long story short, it didn't work out. You know, he had a room and, you know, he was happy and thankful that he, you know, was able to take a few showers, but it ultimately didn't work out for him.
And that's a good point too, because like, for example, where NIMBYs wanted to claim that they are the only ones in the community, their children and all of this nonsensical that they put into it. Unhoused people are usually in places where they get resources and they get acceptance. And people, even though the NIMBYs might not understand it, but I stayed in Chinatown. And the reason why I stayed in Chinatown, because I was really part of the community. They looked after me. Because I was unhoused, I was able to babysit kids, tutor kids, help elderly people with it. And I was, unhoused. Where would you know in other neighborhoods that would have allowed that? Not even close. So when we think about these things, that unhoused people are our neighbors, they are our community members. They are the ones that maybe would see something and they may end up having to save your life if you just looked at them as a human being instead of something to be discarded or to ignore.
Great point. Thanks for that question, though.
Thank you, Jasmine.
Another question. Can you speak on supporting unhoused youth? Theo, I'll let you take that one.
Yes, this one is multi-layered, and I love this question. There are different camps of unhoused youth. There's the one camp, because we don't talk about a lot, is that have been are in the system. That means they are foster kids and youth that does not get the supportive services, that they reach an age, they get the very bare minimum and they're thrown out on the street. And so you will see like them in the Hollywood area. I'm friends with a few of them. And they are like, for example, I don't know any 18-year-old without the support of family and peers that knows what they want to do or the direction they have. Without guidance and without people giving a damn, people just flounder and swim. And I had a formerly unhoused guy that is angry at the world. He has cares nothing about anybody because his experience was so horrific and so disinterested and so cruel. And I feel sorry for him because that's what's missing. If we're to create a new system, dismantling some of the harmful things that we have done in the past, we have got to invest in the youth, not just the ones that are in school. That the youth that I'm also talking about is like Alicia's three children that are living in a car. When people talk about how the safety of their kids, but Alicia's kids are just the safety. And you're passing that crap on when these kids go to school, talking about their mommy and daddy is unsafe and they're dangerous people. And, you know, kids are cruel. They'll say all kinds of things. The other part of the youth is that there is the youth that are unhoused. Literally, we just had a unhoused woman give birth out in a tent on the street yesterday. So that's another thing. I had Philosophical Beast. He was a violinist. He was born into houselessness. His mama was unhoused. And that's all he knows. He's unhoused. And, you know, he took up some skills. He left home at 13. Actually, it wasn't home. It was some foster place, and he lives out on the street. I believe his name was Mitchell. He was thrown out of his foster care when he was 10, so he had to fend for himself at 10 years old. So these are the systems that when we talk about unhoused people, sometimes we only look at the adult, but these are the hidden part of it. Conversely, the elderly unhoused. You know, can you imagine your mother, your grandparents out here living, eating out of a garbage can or stocking up on dog food and trying to survive out here in the street? No, you can't. But you still have NIMBYs running around on social media and running around telling them to get a job, you know, stop taking off the dole. So these things, it's a real issue, and it really needs to be highlighted and really taken to a conversation to a point where it's just not cut and dry.
Yeah, I've interviewed people that were involved in the foster system. Mm-hmm. You know, some of these people, they end up being homeless because there's just no other option. After they turn a certain age, they're basically not able, my understanding at least, is that they're, you know, not able to take advantage over services, and a lot of them get pushed onto the streets.
I hope I answered the question.
Echo Park Lake.
Okay. I missed the question. What was that?
I did too. Hold on, I'll pull it up. I saw a lot about in the news in March about the raid on Echo Park with hundreds of heavily armed cops and how LA council members did not give prior notice and lied about it being a sweep. I also recently saw how people experiencing homelessness near Union Station were forced to move for the Oscars. How can we hold elected officials accountable for things like this? Yeah, I think a lot of people were really frustrated by Mitch O'Farrell's response to the sweeps at Echo Park Lake, because he just denied it and gave a lot of misleading information, saying that everybody got into some form of shelter. We of course know through many people's reporting that was not the case. People ended up in alleyways, on streets. Some people
outside the shelter too. Like the one I was talking with was way out in Palmdale. They left him sleep out in the streets. That's another thing. It was another conversation. There was Mitch O'Farrell, point blank, is lying. He is cherry picking people that that he uses to say that he housed over 209 people. He did not. I've talked with him. I've had personal experience with him. And there are still people, not just in like Koreatown or every other place, because of his armed military response. And one of the things I believe we could do to hold people accountable is that for some reason we can hold up and create all kind of ballots for the most inane things. We could do ballots of saying that we can eradicate special enforcement zones. We can get the people and put it on the ballot, and we vote for it and stop it. And stop that. We could also point out that, you know, that the police shouldn't accompany a cleanup or have sanitation not connected with it. We can do those kind of political actions, but it takes political will, it takes organization, and it takes us, really all of us, housed and unhoused people, coming together and becoming unified enough to do it.
And as a writer, I would write about that stuff and hopefully amplify it. Okay, we got another question, looks like. Oops. Sorry, do you see the question, Theo?
I only saw part of it. Hold on, let me see here.
I'll pull it up. I got it. Actually, no, it wasn't a question.
Okay. That's not it.
Did anybody have a chance to watch some of the episodes that Theo linked? Any thoughts on his podcast or questions? Do you see that one?
This was in the earlier days of me being in the house, and I didn't, was trying to feel out where I could go safely in Los Angeles. I was in the house in other places, and you got to feel where it's safe. But here, the reason why I was on buses is I found that in the later evening, the traffic is lighter, and unhoused people usually get on the bus and sleep until the one end of the stop until the other. And 720 particularly was the one I usually go, because it runs pretty much all night. You'll have to, you know, and coming from all the way downtown of Commerce City, all the way to now Santa Monica, that's a good, reasonable way to be able to sleep and know that you won't be attacked because you're on a bus and most of the unhoused people are there. But I also noticed that there were a lot of women that were sleeping on the bus, and they were dressed in the most older, unshabbily kind of heavy clothes. And, you know, after befriending them, I understood why, because they didn't want to be sexually assaulted from housed or unhoused people. And the threat is a very real threat, you know, because when you're a woman unhoused, their house people would drive up and think you're a sex worker. And you have to deal with all of that that comes along with it. You know, so those are different issues that goes on dealing with that. Or they also sleep on the train, which people that are coming from work or going to work complain about because it is, there's the smell, but you don't offer showers for them. What do you expect?
Got a couple of other good questions. Theo, I think you should handle this first one. Could you also speak to the unhoused experience in light of the pandemic too? Oh. Of course, you know, when the pandemic hit, dining rooms shut down, a lot of service providers shut down. And
I experienced that. And it's a very good question. I was doing it, weirdly enough, I was starting in the early stages of my Weedy Unhoused podcast before the pandemic, and it was so crazy. And I injured and broke my ankle. And so I was mobility impacted. So I could tell you literally the day before and the day after. The day before, everyone was bustling around, scampering, trying to, shelter in place. The next day was like the day the earth stood still. It was a challenge trying to find a bathroom. It took me over 2 hours to try to find a bathroom. And then two, it was another ordeal to find something because there were no restaurants. And most importantly, when you go to the stores, that was the eye-opening experience, because housed people were hoarding everything. Unhoused people couldn't get anything. I mean, even if you had money, you couldn't get the things that would have been leased, even like in a 99-cent store, I couldn't get anything. And then going to Ralph's, the line was wrapped around, people were fighting over toilet paper, people were fighting, I mean, just, you know, bath wipes. It was just, it was unbelievable. So I definitely created some diaries about that. And also I went out and started to take the We In House podcast to different areas. And a lot, it's so unbelievable, the hunger that was out there, because some of the places that used to help unhoused people with food and things, everybody panicked and no one was out there servicing. So when I did have food, or when the mutual aid groups like Polo Pantry, thanks Melissa Alcidero, I would go and give different food. It was like people were so hungry, they wouldn't sit down and eat. They would roughly open the package and scarf down the food, because that is how much of a dearth of services the city just, you know, of course, they decided to do Project Room Key, not because of out of altruistic motive, because they were afraid that if unhoused people had caught COVID-19, they would flood the hospitals and housed people couldn't use it. So they decided to use that was their impetus for doing that.
Yeah, to add on to that, I started reporting on hand washing stations when the pandemic hit. The city rolled out hundreds of hand washing stations and portable toilets
after protests.
Right. It took months and it took weeks, rather. Mm-hmm. And by that point, a lot of organizers had already created their own hand washing stations that were easier for some people to use. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's something I began reporting on, because they rolled out all these hand washing stations, but quickly people noticed that they weren't being maintained properly for soap, water, paper towels. And keep in mind, this is a basic service that people had been asking for years through the Services Not Sweeps campaign, which is a coalition of different organizations in LA that are pushing.
I'm with that.
Exactly, that are pushing for services over sweeps. So that was another thing. I mean, the city tried to respond to homelessness in this so-called unprecedented way. And, you know, in some cases, like as far as the hand washing stations, I've continued to report on those for the past 14 months. And porta potties, which are arguably even worse.
Yeah.
Long story short, many of them still aren't being maintained.
Absolutely. And I wasn't as intensively involved as you were, but I definitely made it a point to go around and investigating because also, people forget, people got to go to the bathroom, whether you're housed or unhoused. And I hear all the time, well, I see people using the bathroom, but you don't have bathrooms for unhoused people. I had, when I had injured my ankle and I was going to Starbucks in Chinatown, they refused to give me to go to the bathroom, even if I, because I was disabled. They said that, you know, you have, you know, I have to buy something. And I was like, dude, you know, public bathroom is like, it's a necessity. You know, we know everyone has to do it. After basically putting them about to put them on camera, they said, okay, fine, but you can't go and wash up into the bathroom. I said, well, needless to say, this is the issues that unhoused people have to constantly deal with from housed individuals.
Got a couple more good questions in here. Any stories, thoughts on the Skid Row decision as far as that the settlement goes and this this plan to clear Skid Row by the fall?
It's not going, it's a gateway to criminalization. I agree with Los Angeles Community Action Network's position on that, because it is. It's like, because you have to force them to do the, and they're just doing the bare minimum. They're forcing people to go into these programs that are already carceral. They have programs like Union Rescue Mission, LA Mission, and these places that unhoused people have avoided like the plague to be forcing them into it. Or then they created tiny sheds. These things are offering not any solutions, because they know deep down NIMBYism is not going to allow them to do what they need to have done. And we have to basically have an open wholesale idea that we need to create housing, public housing, supportive housing, and recovery places and housing that could be intermixed.
Yeah, that announcement was shocking to me. You know, I know people in Skid Row. That's actually kind of how I got into reporting on the unhoused community. And I think I just want to point one thing out about Skid Row is historically it's been a predominantly Black neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You know, going back to the early 20th century, and even today, you know, a lot of the people, the unhoused people in Skid Row are people of color, and particularly Black people. So yeah, I think that says a lot about, you know, this idea of clearing out Skid Row. Let's see. Someone else had the same question about the Judge Carter order. Thanks for the questions. Anything else?
I have a question. How many people think that the housing crisis is the reason for houselessness? And how many people think that white supremacy has its fingerprints all through this? That's something as social workers, maybe, or to be social workers, need to answer that question within themselves, because there's a lot of that going on. There's 40% unhoused people are Black, and they make only 13% of the population. And the issue is this, it begs the question is, why is that? Because it cannot be that over 40% of unhoused people don't want to work. That's not it. It has to be some vestigial issues. It's just not this high rising cost. Because if you look at the history of Blacks in America, that we've always have been displaced and disfranchised all the way from we got here on Plymouth Rock until the time when the civil rights, or actually to the Civil War, when they put us in concentration bowls or concentration camps. And then two, that any time that we had tried to get housing or affordable housing, we were blocked out of it, redlining and other kind of sundown towns and things like that. And if you keep continually keeping these kind of systems in place, what do you think is gonna happen? Then you create homeowner associations, then you create neighborhood councils, and you got gentrification, which is another extent. So those issues in other communities are being told the boogeyman is Black people. For example, I get so many times when we're looking for places to find other cultures, I have drinking from the well of white supremacy, and they don't want to rent from people of color, or Black, I should say, because they have the stereotypes in their mind. What can we do to decolonize our mind is the question.
Yeah, maybe in the chat, people could just say what they think the root of homelessness is, or... Don't be shy.
It's amazing that we have so many people here. I just thought, when I first saw, I had did a cursory glance, I only seen like maybe like five or six people. Now we got...
The problem of houselessness reminds me of the problem of incarceration.
Absolutely. They are interlinked, because after you become, if you become released from the incarceration, you become into a new incarceration system. And that's houselessness and dealing with, you can't find a home, or you can't find places where you can find a livable wage. You may find the odd job here and there, but how are you going to sustain yourself and exploding, rising housing costs, as well as, you know, dealing with the racism that ensues as a result of that. I actually tried to apply for an apartment a while ago, and now I don't have any criminal record, obviously, but I had my credit score. It's not, so obviously they didn't rent to me. Surprise, surprise. So that's another form of discrimination. And then also, mind you, we're in the pandemic. Who the hell has perfect credit score during the pandemic? Because a lot of things has been going on, but that's just the tool that you use. It's easily to justify it.
Yeah, it reminds me of some of the barriers that people encounter with Section 8 vouchers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Here's a good one. I'd be curious to hear your perspectives on how policymakers, social workers, and urban planners do a better job of partnering with journalists and utilizing the incredible journalism work y'all are doing.
I think it may be better because mainstream media misses the mark. So I wouldn't partner with them, but I would think like these kind of things like them. But I would also rattle off a few names that I think would be great. I would say Lex, of course, Lisa Kwan, Alyssa Walker, Zarina Carsada, Emma Albert Reyes, these type of journalists, because they are a little bit of outliers because they take a little bit more time getting to know unhoused people in some respect and want to bend the conversation a little bit instead of what their editors want, more of a punchier line. So I think these kind of conversations that policymakers need to do, and also they need to also listen to like things like We Unhoused, because they're a wealth of experience of unhoused people that are telling people what the issues are in these places. And if you're going to be doing any type of policy making, you should be coming from there instead of some blowhard that owns a shelter and thinks that we need more pro-police and, you know, more criminalization and more tough love and all that craziness that they got going on in these places.
Yeah, and I'll just add, I'm always interested in telling stories that other people aren't telling, and you know, if you can grab me with a story idea, you know, I think that's a great way to connect with journalists.
Well, actually, it's funny you ask. There is a current one that I have been mulling on June 19th. That I am doing a We the Unhoused Have Talent Too. I did a fundraiser last month, but I want to do, and this is the premise, that I need support. And it's like, if house people could come to give me some help with this, it would be even greater. Imagine, because we have so much talent that's in the unhoused community. I want to create a place where unhoused people have a place to show their creativity and then show it as if they win, I wanted to fundraise the money for them. Let's say one of the prizes is a 1 week stay at a hotel where they don't have to worry about the stresses of sweeps and the rains and rains that happen. 2 week for, you know, a 3 week for the three prize winners, having unhoused judges. And these kind of creative things need help. I need, of course, I need money, but I also need emotional or people that are willing to invest in creating some a consortium to do this or help fundraise with me so I can be able to help as many unhoused people as I can. I'm unhoused, but I always believe that only when, you know, once I've gotten this door open, I've always promised to try to make sure I get other people into the door. Why it's even look cracked, and if I can hold it, get as many people uplifted as I possibly can. So that's one of the direct actions that is still going on now. I have a power up. I'm always in need of fundraising. I'll leave my Venmo in the chat. You know, if you feel moved, you can pass the collection plate.
One thing I'll say is Theo is very determined, and if he says he's going to do something, then he's probably going to do it.
I have a question and I can't type it fast enough. I'm wondering like how we also like, in addition to building up like orgs and individuals doing great work, how do we delegitimize these like really old school service models? Like you were mentioning like Union Rescue Mission and all of these places, like, is there a, do you think it's a worthy use of effort to like work to think through like how much money they get, how many like UCLA students spend their time volunteering there, et cetera? Do you think that's a valuable use of time to think about that? And if so, like how do you go about kind of breaking that model down?
I'm definitely for dismantling these things. These kind of mission kind of ideas are back from the early 1500s. And we just basically inherited an infection. So if we could stop doing emotional labor or creating emotional labor to these places that's causing harm and pushing for new systems. It's one of the reasons why I like Black Lives Matter. We are trying to reimagine public safety and public resources. We could do that. We have our part to play in that too. So instead of a UCLA going there, they can go to my power-ups. They could, instead of UCLA, I see UCLA, I don't know if you know that there is an unhoused UCLA group there on campus. I mean, if it's not well known, it says, here is, they are doing things there. But what I would like to see UCLA students do instead of just handing out food is, with my help, is create a power-up there. And I think because that is the most radical, that is one of the things, the energy are there, that they understand these issues, what is going on in Westwood area and how gentrification and how sometimes the harm, even though you may not be actively causing it, but you can be accidentally harming people and not understanding what, you know, what is your presence there, why the police is always there. Of course, they're trying to get police off. I heard on UCLA, which is great too. But that ties into it, because I remember when I would go to UCLA, when I would go to Westwood, I used to sleep in the the Barnes and Nobles before it got shut down, and I would try to sneak into UCLA and take a quick bird bath. But of course, you know, that was like Mission Impossible, because it was like, I have to time it. I have to look like I belong there. I have to time how I can run into the bathroom without people running back to the librarian or the public safety. So once a lot of the youth that gets there, they have already been indoctrinated into the anti-Black or anti-in-house sentiment that's going on too.
Another great question just came in. What are some steps that we can take as a society to stop stigmatizing the unhoused? One thing I'll say is that there are a lot of groups that do, that have like monthly meetings, and they'll actually give you some training about doing outreach and you know, how to communicate with the unhoused community. So you can always look into something like that. Theo, any suggestions?
I think one of the things as well, like, again, I have to say, I hate to say this, we need a house, because I take a lot of labor into doing that, talking it from the perspective of unhoused people, learning some of the terminologies that we use, looking at some of the, like I say, like listening to the episodes, but also looking at the videos, because there's a lot of other things that sometimes the auditory experience misses, but you visually see some of the things that I do or what I do and how you engage with people like in their home. The smallest thing. You don't see, if I was to come up to your house, I don't just open the door and just walk in. I don't knock, I don't ask, you know, I just walk in and sit down. You don't do that. And unhoused people's places of where they live, it's their home. You know, it may be outdoors, but it's still their home. And you have to remember that and accord them the same courtesy and the same respect that they would to allow you in or not allow you in. They're usually going to allow you in, but showing that shows a different dynamic anyway, because how many people that you know that will do that to unhoused people? Probably not very many. Police come in, they come in hitting with the baton on their tent or yelling, screaming through with a baton, their bulldozer, bullhorn, and there you have it, so.
Theo, someone asked if they could include your Linktree website and Patreon as well.
Oh, yeah, please do. Absolutely. Like I said, I'm always looking for it because I've been trying to reach the goal of 1,000 patrons, but I cannot seem to ever get it. They start off strong and then they fizzle out, you know.
Someone asked how they can facilitate a UCLA/Westwood power up.
Well, you're more than welcome to reach out to me. Let me I don't know how I can get, if you have an email, I'll send you my email so you can we can have a conversation on what we can do in doing that. And I look forward to, I'm excited that you guys are interested in that. That gives me hope because of the young, because I believe, this is my belief, is that the older generation is going to only go so far, but I do believe, as the educator in me, believes the younger generation can have have more power and control of dismantling this more so than the younger the older generation. So if I can get any more of the younger generation to do this before I become, you know, leave this planet, I'd be very happy.
Very cool. Well, I just want to thank everybody for joining us again. I got an email, Theo, just before we logged on. Some people from Portland actually, I guess, joined us. They were asking for the link. So really happy that people outside of the classroom also joined us for this conversation. It was great talking with you, Theo. Like I said, we don't get to talk that much outside of interviews. Yeah, if anyone has any just last minute questions, we could take those. But if not, I think we might call it pretty soon.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Aaron.
Yeah, thank you all. Thank you, Joshua.
Isabel?
Yeah, make sure to subscribe to.
Yes, and that's another one more thing before I make run out here. I've been looking to go. I get to the point, and I'm really proud of that. I finally got to 1,000 YouTube subscribers. Please go and subscribe on that YouTube thing because I've been trying to do the 10,000 one. You know, I can be balling and getting to the big time. But 1,000 is nothing to sneeze at. I was very happy about that.
I think they say that the first 1,000 is the hardest, and then gets gradually easier.
I hope so, but I have to say the listeners that I usually, the people that subscribe, usually that I've watched, these are pretty decent people. Thanks. You know, they really are genuinely interested. It's not, like I say, it's not algorithm friendly. I'm not trying to coddle NIMBYs because I don't really care what they're, because you know, that's a wasted amount of my time. I want to be able to talk to people that really are genuinely interested in learning. So I think that's the teacher in me, oh yeah, I'm gonna definitely push for that. But you know, that's the thing, you know, because I know that that's there's a lot of NIMBY inspired podcasts and videos out there, and they're getting hundreds of thousands of people. And I'm like, I cannot believe that that many people are that hateful. And we have so many people that really care that just doesn't want to push for this. So yeah, so please like and subscribe.
Yeah, and if anyone wants to follow my work, I'm on Twitter at shot on 35mm.
Also, before we get logged out, we have some business to discuss. Lex, what's up with the taco thing? You supposed to hook a brother up. Yeah, I got the card. You know, I'm looking for my taco spot. So, you know, don't leave.
Oh, yeah. I gotta send you that list. Yeah, LA Taco like, has.
Yeah, I got the card, but I can't do nothing with it.
Yeah, I'll let you know that that's where you can use it, man. Yeah. Yeah, and also if anyone wants to support my work, you can become an LA Taco member. We have a membership program where you get a bunch of perks, including free tacos, a newsletter. So please subscribe to LA Taco. Yes, free tacos.
Yeah, hook up a brother.
Awesome. Thank you both so much. Lexus, you forgot to mention, you also have such beautiful prints available as well. Yep. He was present reporting on the uprising that was happening at the beginning of the pandemic. And he took some beautiful photos. I know I was really admiring them. I know that he has them available. Theo also has merch available as part of We The Unhoused, so don't forget to support that as well. And I just can't thank you both enough for joining us and sharing your insight. I think these are, when Natalie and I were designing this class, I can't stress enough how, you know, we wanted to invite the voices that oftentimes aren't heard, and we wanted to go ahead and uplift those voices, right? And those stories, those narratives. So thank you all for sharing your experiences with us.
Thank you for having me. And like I say, I'm very encouraged that people are willing to listen to us after such a very long time of not being heard or seen and dismissed. So it's very refreshing to have people actually wanting to hear it.
Yeah, thanks again for setting this up, Savannah and Natalie. We really appreciate you having us.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.